This isn't the time to be stubborn. Surely your own court would be equipped to help you. I didn't say better equipped, because I had nothing at all to offer him. It didn't escape me that he still hadn't answered my earlier question. He hadn't told me he wasn't dying.
No,
he said again. I set my jaw and began walking us back the way we'd come. Rook pointed out a different direction, and I adjusted our path. Though I suspected he was lighter than a human man, he leaned more weight on me than I could comfortably bear, and the vast difference in our heights made lugging him along an awkward trial. I kept my eyes averted from his gaunt face, and after a time, his blood started soaking into my dress. It didn't smell at all like human blood. It had a crisp, resiny scent, like a tree bitten by an axe. It was almost full dark now. It wasn't as easy to see here as it was in the autumn lands, where the trees brought color to the night. Rook's hand did something in the air, a twisting motion that made his glamourless fingers look even more insectal, and after a moment I realized he was trying, and failing, to summon a fairy light. Dread trickled down my back, pulling at the base of my spine. What if we were attacked again? He had no power left.
I cannot seek help from my own kind.
His breathy, gasping words startled me after so long a silence.
We retain our sovereignty, not through the love or respect of our courts, but through power alone. To see me weakened so by a mere barrow lord, my court would wonder whether I might be replaced, and whether anyone among them might be the right person to do it. Already, there has been doubt cast on my suitability as prince, not once, but twice. I hoped to undo the second.
He paused, regaining his strength. I realized he was talking about the portrait and my trial. But what was the first?
A third show of weakness would mean my end, without question.
I shook my head. That's cruel. All of it was. Him to me, and them to him.
Such is our nature. It may be cruel, but it is also fair.
He looked down. My vision was fading, but in the hard lines of his profile I saw that he doubted himself. I recognized the rage when he had stolen me away for what it truly was. Fear. Fear that his power was slipping. Fear that there was something wrong with him, that he wasn't worthy of his crown, and that others could see it now too. Because I had painted it in his eyes. As plain as day. I don't think it's fair at all, I said, anger pitching my voice low.
Only because you are a human, the strangest of all creatures.
He spoke in little more than a whisper.
What if I told you I could send you back to Whimsy? There is power in a fair one's death, enough to show the way.
Don't toy with me. Tears started in my eyes.
I'm not,
he whispered.
I'm not.
Hoped to undo the second, he had said. Not hope. I didn't say a word after that, because I didn't have any that would make sense to him. All I had were human emotions, no doubt as clamoring and riotous to a fair one as a flock of squabbling parrots, and no way to quiet them down. When I finally did speak, it was only to let him know I could walk no farther. At that point, he barely clung to consciousness. He went to free himself and slid from my shoulder like a sack of grain, his tall form crumpling down. My heart leapt sideways before I saw that he had caught himself on his hands. With a groan, he turned over and sprawled onto his back. One hand was at his wound again, and I resisted the urge to tell him to stop touching it as if he were a child. I realized what he was doing when he pulled the hand away and held it over the ground. He waited, and I felt his regard.
If I don't leave you tonight, I asked.
The chance will have passed. The hunt will pick up your scent too quickly.
I swallowed once, twice. Surely I was mad. I glanced at his bloody hand. We're still in the Summerlands.
I am a prince yet,
he said. And looking at that inhuman, sharp-boned face, lying in repose in a tangled nest of curls, those eyes feverish with resolve, I thought, yes, you are, aren't you? I lifted the folds of my skirt and sat down on a rock.
It was all the answer Rook needed. He plunged his hand into the soil, long fingers grasping down. This was no offering to the earth, but a command to it, and the forest surged around us. Bramble roots as wide around as kitchen tables heaved up from the ground, bristling with thorns longer and more wicked than any sword. When they reached their full height, they branched, heaving higher, knotting together, until they gathered us up in a fortress like something out of an old tale, a place where a cursed princess slept imprisoned. I was gladdened by the sight of those vicious thorns more than I could say, and wondered whether the stories would have gone any differently if the princesses had been the ones telling them. When the last tendrils snarled into formation beneath the moon, shattering it like a broken mirror, Rook sighed and went still. Waking up that morning was worlds different than the morning previous. The jagged scraps of sky showing through the brambles were so overcast I couldn't tell whether it was before dawn or after. Dew had settled on me overnight, leaving my clothes sodden and my skin so clammy my fingers and toes had gone numb. I was immediately conscious of how sore I felt and how disgusting a state I was in. Of my entire body, only my shoulder felt warm, but in a moist, disagreeable way that set my skin crawling. I found it covered in moss where Rook's blood had soaked through my dress and hastily peeled the growth off in clumps. Then I rolled over and found Rook dead beside me. He lay sprawled a few feet away in exactly the same position I'd last seen him. His hand was still buried in the dirt, and his face was sepulchral. I wouldn't have thought it possible for him to grow any paler overnight, but he seemed to have done so. I went to him, my damp, grimy skirt flapping against my legs as I moved. I stood over his body, and for a moment just looked. I'd gambled everything on his survival. More than was wise, I admitted to myself, as a gray bleakness engulfed me, chased by a weak flutter of hope. Because I was wrong. He had to be alive. His spilled blood had turned to moss overnight, but his body remained whole. If he were dead, I wouldn't be looking at him now, not intact, not like this. I dropped to my knees and splayed my hand across his chest. When I felt it rise and fall shallowly beneath the rags of his coat, I breathed out an uneven laugh, shaken by relief. I reached for the coat's edge to peel it back from his wound. My sleeve caught on his raven pin, and cold metal sprang against my wrist. I pulled away. I'd tripped a catch. The bird had a hidden compartment inside. I would be lying if I claimed the secret it revealed surprised me. There were precious few explanations for Rook's behavior, and this was proof of the most likely one. A curl of blonde human hair nested inside the compartment, carefully tied together with blue thread. I remembered how he'd insisted on removing the pin for his portrait. Even then he had fumbled to protect himself, his reputation, from his damningly mortal grief. He wore it still, though the pin's tarnish and antique craftsmanship gave it away as 200 or 300 years old. Gently, I closed the pin, but I had to press down on his chest to secure the latch, and I think it hurt because his eyes flew open. Their unearthliness in the light of day gave me an unpleasant jolt. They were glassy, burning with fever. He tried to move and started panting.
"I feel strange,"
he announced, struggling to focus on the empty air beside me. "You look strange." I steeled myself and touched his forehead, which proved hot as an oven against my chilled fingers. "I was under the impression fair folk didn't get fevers," I said, concerned.
"What's a fever?"
he demanded with a scowl, which didn't improve my fears. "It happens when a wound goes bad. I'm going to touch this." I indicated his clothes, and he tensed, but nodded. While he waited for me to do my work, he took his hand out of the dirt, inspected it, then cast about for something to wipe it off on. I had the annoyed suspicion he considered my dress before he victimized a patch of moss instead. I peeled his coat open, and my stomach flopped over. The flesh around the wound had turned black, black veins spiderwebbed out of it, vanishing beneath the edges of his clothes. How extensively had the poison spread? I dragged his coat and the shirt underneath open farther, undoing buttons toward his waist without a care for preserving his modesty, or my own, for that matter, as while I'd educated myself thoroughly on the subject, I'd never seen a man undressed. Rook propped himself up on an elbow. Despite his weakness, he suddenly looked very interested in whatever I might be doing. Then his eyes alit on his chest. He cried out in disgust and seized his clothes from my hands, fastened the buttons back up, and stood with more alacrity than I would have thought possible. I evaluated him warily. In some ways, he had greatly improved. But as fevers went, this could be the final blaze before his body burned itself to ashes. "You can't just pretend it isn't there," I told him, climbing to my feet.
"But it's hideous,"
he replied, as though this were a reasonable objection. "Festering wounds are always hideous." I ignored the affronted look he gave me at the word festering, perhaps under the impression that I'd just insulted him. "Do you have any idea why this is happening?" He turned his back to me, lifted his collar rather squeamishly, and peered under it.
"That land wasn't right. The Barrow Lord shared its affliction and appears to have passed it on to me. Temporarily, of course."
That didn't sound good at all. "Rook, I think you need medical treatment."
"And you know how to treat me?" "No, so I thought. We resume our course toward the Autumnlands, which should not take long now that I can walk unaided."
He avoided my eyes as he said this. Last night clearly wasn't one of his proudest moments.
"Whatever turn my wound has taken, it won't matter once I can properly heal. Therefore, we're better off leaving without delay."
I grudgingly admitted that in this matter, he knew better than I. He strode to the edge of the brambles, weaving only a little, and set his hands on one of the thorny coils. They began wriggling like worms, and retracted to form a doorway. I hastened after him, wincing at the chafe of my soiled skirts around my legs. The forest we emerged into wasn't as ominous as the place with the standing stones, but it still had an ill look about it that I hadn't noticed in the dark and couldn't easily explain. The green leaves were too glossy and glittering, almost as though a fever lay upon them, too. The sun labored to burn away the soupy mist I'd mistaken for clouds. While we traveled, I couldn't shake my memories of last night. Whiffs of imaginary decay dogged my steps. Inspecting myself, I found a smear on my left stocking where the corpse had seized my ankle. It was all I could do not to stop and tear the stocking off right then and there. In the way of minor discomforts, now that I'd noticed it, I couldn't put it out of my mind, maddened by the way it itched in the summer heat. And with that thought, something occurred to me. "The Thane was from the Summerlands too, wasn't it?" I asked Rook. "The one you destroyed the day we met. The temperature changed when it appeared, same as the Barrow Lord, but nothing like that happened with the Wild Hunt's hounds." Reluctantly, he nodded. I narrowed my eyes. "And what about the unusual number of wild fairy beasts you told me about? Were the rest of those coming from the Summerlands as well?"
"Ah," Rook said. "A strange coincidence indeed, now that you mention it."
"I sincerely doubt it has anything to do with coincidence." I grabbed fistfuls of my skirt and trundled up next to him, feeling dirtier and more disgusting by the minute. Good. He deserved it. "You mean the connections never occurred to you before? Do you have any critical thinking skills at all?" He stared straight ahead in full hauteur.
"Of course I do. I am a..."
"Yes, I know. You're a prince. Never mind." I got the distinct feeling he'd never heard the term critical thinking before in his life. "Have any of the other courts been talking about it, then?" I pressed on. He tore his crown off and ruffled his hair.
"Why is this so important to you?"
he exclaimed, vexed. "Why is it..." I halted in my tracks. He turned around when he noticed I'd fallen several paces behind. "Why? Because a fairy beast from the Summerlands probably killed my parents. Because one almost killed me. Twice! Because they're going to kill more humans if nobody figures out what's going on. You know, just stupid, mortal reasons." He paused. I clenched my fists against the unhappiness stealing across his expression. I didn't want him to feel bad and apologize. I wanted him to understand.
"We do not speak of such things," he said finally. "At all. Because we cannot. We cannot think of such things. Even this conversation puts you and me in grave danger.
Like bile, the forbidden words crept up the back of my throat. Shuddering, I swallowed them down. Rook wasn't responsible for the fairy beasts, and while he was, to be fair, entirely at fault for dragging me into the forest in the first place, he had nearly died last night protecting me. This I couldn't deny. He drooped in his ragged clothes, and the crown shook between his fingers. He labored for breath. Arguing had obviously taxed him. "I'm sorry," we both said at the same time, in identically grudging voices. A startled smile tugged at the corner of his mouth. It was my turn to avoid his eyes. I took a deep breath, determined to address one more thing before we went on. "We need to talk about what you said last night."
"I hate it when people tell me that," he replied. "It's never good."
"Rook, you aren't still taking me to trial, are you? You've changed your mind." I'm not sure what reaction I anticipated. Perhaps for him to draw himself up and say, "You claim to know the mind of a prince?" Anything but the way he looked aside and uneasily toyed with his raven pin.
"I realize now that I made a mistake," he confessed. "You did not intentionally sabotage me. What you did with your craft was..."
He struggled to find words, incapable of describing that which he didn't understand.
"When I came to fetch you," he went on instead, "I told no one of my plans. We won't be missed in the Autumn Court. Once I have healed, I promise to return you to Whimsy."
The strength went out of my knees, and I steadied myself on a tree trunk. I was going home. Home, to Emma and the twins, my safe, warm house filled with the smell of linseed oil, the work I already missed so much. And yet, back to the endless summer, and the way things were before, a life that crept along to the endless buzzing of grasshoppers in the wheat. I'd leave the autumn land's wonders behind forever. My heart soared and plummeted by turns like a bird buffeted by a storm. If I felt like this too long, I'd tear myself apart. But what could I do? How could I stop? And what exactly had finally gotten the truth through to Rook? I studied him. His expression was impassive, but the way he ran his fingers over the raven pin, his eyes getting duller and duller, worsened the turbulence battering my spirits. "What of you?" I asked. "Your reputation. What will you do next?" He mustered himself and replied,
"I will think of some..."
Just like that, he stopped. His jaw worked.
"Let us not speak of it," he finished oddly. "Do you see that hill ahead? Once we reach the top, we'll be back in the autumn lands."
I squinted. The hill looked no different to me than the forest behind us. While I puzzled over this, I realized why Rook hadn't been able to finish his sentence. It had been a lie. Nine. As soon as we crested the hill, it was autumn again. I turned a full circle. Gently swaying birches stretched into the distance across a forest painted in dreamy tones of white and gold. I took a step back, and another, but the summerlands didn't reappear. "This doesn't make any sense," I said. Rook didn't hear me. He'd leaned against the first autumn tree we'd come to and stood propped up like a scarecrow in his torn coat. His eyes were closed, and the relief on his face was profound. I was glad to see it, because after our last conversation, his fever had seemed to sap his strength. He'd barely made it up the hill. I waited for at least an hour for him to recover. I sat down and tried lying down, but the leaves tickled my neck, and I couldn't relax in such a vulnerable position. My fears and worries and longings and questions jangled around in my head, and the weight of my dirty, scratchy clothes and my own smell were apt to drive me mad now that I didn't have anything to distract me. Every time I glanced at Rook, he hadn't moved. Finally, I approached him. "I hear running water nearby," I said. "I'm going to go find it. I'm thirsty, and I need to wash up." I didn't expect him to respond, but his eyes opened halfway, and he regarded me as though in a trance. I fought back a shudder. It wasn't like being looked at by a person. His gaze lacked sentience, as though the forest, not him, stared through his eyes. Then he blinked, and the impression went away.
Follow me. It's safer here than in the Summerlands, but you shouldn't wander around by yourself.
He scrutinized me.
You are quite filthy, he added,
as if only just now noticing it. Thank you. I'm in good company. His indignation didn't stop him from replying inevitably.
You're welcome.
After he'd bit out the reluctant words, he swanned the rest of the way down to the brook and knelt on its mossy bank, reviewing his own reflection. I spied a patch of honeysuckles I could use for privacy. I wanted to rinse my clothes and let them dry a bit before I put them back on. A scrubbing would accomplish little in the way of comfort if my dress remained stiff as treated canvas with mud and horse sweat.
I was without my glamour this whole time,
Rook said behind me. He had a question in his voice. I turned and found him staring at the water, aghast. Well, yes. I wasn't certain what else to say. Ever since you were injured by the Barrow Lord, or no, a little after that, when you slew it and passed out.
You've been looking at me.
Yes, I said again. Baffled, I went on. It was hardly avoidable. His expression hardened.
Stop this instant, he said in a cool voice.
I stood there a moment longer, out of sheer perplexity, not resistance. But the look he leveled at me was so hair-raising, I wasted no time vanishing behind the shrubs. Don't look at me, either, I called back to him. Bathing is private, like peeing. He didn't respond. Well, that would have to do. Glancing all around, I pulled off my shoes, shucked my dress and underthings, and clambered, shivering, into the brook. I'd washed in colder from the well back home, but the water had a bite to it, and I didn't waste time as I rinsed my hair and did my best to scrape some of the grime off with my fingernails. I dragged my clothes in with me and sloshed them around last, making a face at the cloud of dirt and horsehair they released into the clear shallows. Leaves floated along on the surface, twirling in the eddies I made. They were such marvelous colors I considered keeping one. Here was a buttery leaf, an almost perfect match for lead-tin yellow, and here a vibrant orange one shot through with green. But I realized I wouldn't be able to decide on a single souvenir, let alone a dozen, and discarded the idea with a wistful twinge. When I was finished, I crept back onto the bank and spread my dress and stockings on top of the honeysuckle where they might catch some of the breeze. More self-consciously, I hung my underthings on a pair of lower branches. Then I folded my arms tightly over my chest and pressed up against the bushes, more exposed than I ever had been in my life before. I waited. No sound came from Rook's direction. Misgivings started knocking on the back door in my head, an endless stream of unwelcome visitors. What if he'd passed out, or vanished, leaving me behind? Worse, what if the wild hunt stumbled across us while I was naked? I'd feel much better if I had a look. But dare I? For a time, I couldn't will myself to put my back to the forest. I shifted indecisively, bare toes crunching the leaves, with my hair dripping all around me. Finally, I gained the courage to crouch down low to the ground and peer through the honeysuckle. The branches had a few gaps in them, no larger than coins, that afforded me a near-complete picture of the other side. Rook sat on a flat stone within speaking distance, but some length away from where I had left him, close to a bend in the stream. He'd taken off his shirt, though his trousers were still on, and his coat was draped loose on the ground around him. He was seizing the chance to have a wash, too. In some ways, the ordinariness of it surprised me. Of course fair folk had to wash up from time to time, but he did it in such a regular way, cupping the water in his hands and scrubbing himself down with it, exhibiting no special speed or efficiency that I could determine. Perhaps it would have gone differently if he hadn't been injured. I couldn't picture another fair one, like Gadfly, doing this at all. Feeling like some ill-behaved forest goblin hunkered down in the nude with my wet hair plastered to my shoulders and chest, I waddled over to a new spot and peeked through at a better angle. The wound looked frightful, but better than before. The darkened veins had faded and receded, and the gouge's edges seemed to be closing. I suspected it wouldn't heal without a mark, however, because he had scars from older encounters, a long one across his forearm and another going over his left shoulder. So his taste for battle hadn't been exaggerated by Gadfly or put on for my sake. Would his glamour hide those scars or leave them? Much more importantly, why was I even asking myself that question? I expected to be unnerved by his half-naked form, but the longer I watched, the more he struck me as merely strange as opposed to monstrous. At some point, my mind had stopped trying to see him as a human and accepted him for what he was. There was something undeniably striking about his leanness and his angular face. His eyes still appeared cruel to me, but also pensive. The thrill I felt whenever he looked at me was as captivating as it was dangerous, like having one's gaze met unexpectedly by a lynx or a wolf in the woods at dusk. Which was absolutely the last thing I should be thinking about. That was that. Time for this spying session to end. But when I moved, a twig snapped beneath my heel. Rook paused, then looked over his shoulder straight at me through my leafy pinhole. I jerked upright, dizzy, heart thumping deep and muffled in my chest. My clothes weren't dry, but I seized them off the honeysuckle anyway, bracing myself against the cold cling of my damp underthings, my stockings, the dragging roughness of my dress as I pulled it over my head. I had just finished lacing up my shoes when Rook's footsteps approached and knew he made himself heard deliberately for my benefit.
"Come along,"
was all he said, and with his face averted, offered me his hand. We barely spoke the remainder of the day. If Rook truly had caught me spying, he gave no indication of it, aside from his silence. I was still growing used to this side of him. The smiling, devil-may-care prince I'd known in my parlor, he was real too, but only a part of Rook, and the one I now suspected he preferred to show the world. I tried engaging him in conversation once or twice, but he only gave me perfunctory replies, and eventually I abandoned the effort. His pace was calculated as well. He walked at a speed that allowed me to trail behind him, but not catch up. By the time the daylight faded, I had memorized every individual tear in his coat's hem as it swept over the ground. Yesterday, I think I would have bullied him into acknowledging me, whether he liked it or not, but I didn't have the heart for it now. He was no longer my captor. He was returning me home, and, I suspected, he was doing so at great personal cost, the scope of which eluded my mortal understanding. The shelter he made for us that night was unlike both the Rowan Cathedral and the Fortress of Thorns. Slender yellow ashes and weeping willows sprang from his lifeblood, their branches trailing to the ground. A breeze sighed through the boughs. These were not perfect and elegant trees. Some grew crooked or had knotholes or hosted gatherings of toadstools on their roots. They weren't diseased like the ones in the Summerlands. They were simply flawed and seemed to vie cautiously for my attention, lonely and wary of rejection. Without thinking, I went to one and placed a hand on its bark and looked inside the hole in its trunk. The shadows were too deep for me to see anything. When I turned around, Rook was watching me, frozen halfway in the middle of shedding his coat. It was the first time he'd willingly faced me since the brook. "This is the sort of thing I like painting best," I explained. "The details, the texture." I saw I was losing him. "Perfect subjects make for less interesting work." Slowly, he finished taking his coat off.
"Then I hardly imagine you enjoy painting fair folk," he remarked aloofly.
"Rook," I said with a smile, perhaps a fonder one than I intended, "you can't just go around calling yourself perfect, you know." His shoulders tightened. Somehow I had struck a nerve. With a closed-off expression, he handed me his coat. He'd removed the raven pin.
"The cold won't bother me. I'm aware it's ruined, but it should keep you warm."
Just like that, The source of his frostiness revealed itself. I held his coat in my arms. Sympathy pierced me like a dart, a sharp, exquisite pain. Without willing my feet to move, I found myself standing close enough that I had to tilt my head back to see his face. He tried to turn away, but I touched his shoulder. Marvelously, he stilled. He was a head and a half taller than I, and the forest leapt to obey his power, but with that one touch, I might as well have clapped him in irons. "It doesn't bother me, seeing you without your glamour," I told him. "You aren't unsightly. You aren't ruined." He leaned down and put his face close to mine. The back of my neck prickled, and goose flesh rose on my arms. His inhuman, amethyst eyes moved across my features as though he were reading a letter, and then he made a soft, bitter sound and pulled away.
"And yet you're frightened of me still."
I pushed his shoulder. It wasn't enough to move him against his will, but he took a step back. Color had risen in my cheeks. "Only because you're deliberately being frightening." He had put me off balance, and I was gripped by the sudden, defensive urge to return the favor. "I watched you at the brook, you know, and I kept watching." God, what was I saying? If I had been frightened or disgusted, I wouldn't have. I lifted my chin, though I'm sure the gesture came across rather differently on my diminutive frame. He stared at me.
"Our true forms are loathsome to mortals," he said finally,
as if I'd just declared the moon was made of cheese. "It isn't as though we get a chance to see them very often. Loathsome is a bit of a stretch. How many mortals have seen you without your glamour?" Slowly, he shook his head. I took that to mean none aside from me. Not even the girl who'd given him the raven pin? Oh, Rook. "Well," I was running out of words to say. "That's that, I suppose," I finished awkwardly. "Thank you for your coat." He inclined his head and then stalked off, bringing to mind a tomcat retreating beneath an armchair to nurse his injured dignity. Still blushing hot enough, I was amazed my red face didn't illuminate the clearing. I found a soft patch of moss, cleared it of twigs and leaves, and huddled down for sleep. That night, I dreamed. First, I had the murky awareness that something was trying to infiltrate our shelter. The branches creaked, in one place and then another, as a being's weight stole across the canopy. Through my eyelashes, I saw Rook asleep a few paces away. He lay utterly boneless, with one hand flattened against the ground. I recalled his trance when we'd first entered the Autumn Lands, and it occurred to me that if he was healing himself now, he might not awaken as easily as he would normally. Weariness blurred my vision. Exhaustion lapped at my mind like warm, dark water, sucking me back down in the undertow. When I regained awareness, a figure sat perched in the willow above Rook. It was tall and thin and clung to the branches like a cricket, with its folded knees drawn up past its ears. Its colorless hair floated, its white face was angled down toward him, and it was speaking to him, even though he slept. No, she was speaking to him. Hemlock was.
"It's only you now, Rook," she said.
Her tone was pleasant, but her inflection had a pelting, hissing quality, like rain lashing against a window during a storm.
"Only the Autumn Court remains untouched, and look at you. You're too busy waving your sword about and collecting mortal pets to notice."
Responding to no sound I could detect, she abruptly broke off, tensed, and stared off over her shoulder at nothing. She silently watched the darkness for a time before she turned back to him.
"I am forbidden to speak of it, but you can't hear me, can you? Then I will tell you this. I no longer answer to the Horn of Winter."
Her jade eyes were as unfeeling as polished gemstones.
"Snow melts on the high peaks, and the hunt has a new master. Try as I might, I cannot make a game of things now."
She paused to look over her shoulder again.
So I suppose what I'd like to ask you is, what are we to do when following the good law isn't fair? It's a dreadful question, isn't it?
She spoke in a whisper now. A luminous fascination had entered her eyes, and they seemed to swallow up her face.
Rook, she lowered her voice even further. Do you ever wonder what it would be like to be something other than what we are?
I swear I didn't make a sound, but suddenly Hemlock looked around directly at me with her lustrous cat's eyes and gave me a feral smile. Down, down I sank, down into the dark. It was only a dream. I slept. Rook had moved during the night. When I blinked against the morning light, I found him facing me, close enough to touch, but still asleep. His glamour had returned. For all that I'd grown used to the way he looked without it, I knew him best like this, and was glad to see him restored. My gaze wandered over his eyebrows, arched slightly even in sleep, his long eyelashes, his aristocratic cheekbones and expressive mouth. Good health, or at least the illusion of it, burnished his golden brown skin, and his tousled hair pillowed his head. I noticed an indentation in his cheek, where the dimple appeared when he smiled. He sucked in a breath, trapped halfway between a muffled yawn and a sigh, and his eyebrows furrowed meditatively before he opened his eyes. At first hazy with sleep, his face showed dawning comprehension as he looked back at me, followed by acceptance of where he was and with whom. We lay there watching each other in silence for some time, listening to the breeze sigh through the trees, each time followed by the rustle of leaves falling.
May I touch you?
He asked. At that moment, nothing existed beyond the clearing, beyond us, as though we drifted on a mirror-still sea with no land in sight. Soon we'd part ways. There was no harm in allowing myself this, just once. I nodded. With a fingertip, he traced the curve of my jaw. His touch was so light I barely felt it. His hand brushed the collar of his coat pulled up around my neck, and a trickle of cool autumn air spilled into my warm cocoon. He traced all around the edge of my ear and up toward my forehead. His finger paused near my hairline. Mortified, I realized a blemish had appeared there overnight. Rook, don't touch that.
Why not?
He said. He lifted his finger and regarded my forehead.
It wasn't there yesterday.
You aren't supposed to poke people's spots. It's embarrassing. It's like when I was looking at your wound, I suppose.
Your face isn't festering, nor is it hideous.
Thank you. That's nice. He frowned at my amusement. Haughtily, he said,
Something about you changes every day. Isabel, you're very beautiful.
I harbored no illusions about my appearance. I was neither homely nor pretty. I occupied an unremarkable spot in between. But Rook couldn't lie. Despite his obnoxious tone, he really meant it. It wasn't so much of a stretch to imagine that fair folk saw humans differently than we saw one another. A flutter stirred in my belly, even as I determined not to make too much of it. He was the vain one, not I, and I needed to keep my head out of the clouds. His hand had wandered to my hair, and he spread it out on the moss, combing through the strands with his fingers until it gleamed as straight and smooth as it could get. It seemed impossible that someone who had lived for hundreds of years and hunted fairy beasts for sport could find this entertaining, but his expression was transfixed. I glanced at the trees, suddenly a bit afraid of how much I was enjoying his attention. How much time had passed? Surely we couldn't afford to linger like this. Shadowy anxieties flickered at the edges of my thoughts, some not unpleasant in the slightest, yet it surprised me how worrying about the wild hunt, getting home safely, and the possibility of getting attacked by more fairy beasts paled in comparison to the queasy anticipation of wondering what Rook and I might do if I allowed this to go on much longer. The whole world and its myriad possibilities shrank down to the tingling caress of his fingertips every time they brushed my scalp, all its beauty and all its terror. Did other girls feel like this the first time they let a boy touch them? And not that I was humiliated by it, but even at the age of 17? His knuckles skimmed the nape of my neck. Well, that decided it. "We should get moving," I declared, sitting up. The crisp outside air came as a shock as his coat slid away. But Rook didn't move. He only regarded me indolently from the ground, with a look that plainly said he didn't much feel like going anywhere, thank you very much. "Get up." I nudged his side with my shoe, hoping he couldn't sense how forced my composure truly was. "Come on, we can't lie about all morning like lumps." He allowed my nudge to flop him over onto his back.
"But I'm injured," he complained. "I haven't finished healing myself yet."
"You're looking very well to me. If you insist that you're in pain, however, I ought to take another look at your wound without your glamour on. The inflammation may have returned." His eyes narrowed. Then he extended his hand. Unthinkingly, I reached for it to help pull him up. But as soon as our skin touched, he clasped his fingers around mine and pulled, and I landed on his chest with a thump. The coat drifted down after, settling neatly over our legs. Rook gave me a charming smile. I glared back at him. "I'll use iron on you."
"If you must," he said sufferingly.
"I really will."
"Yes, I know."
I became conscious of the fact that his chest felt very solid, and I was straddling his slim waist. Our uneven breathing rocked us against each other slightly. Molten heat pooled in me again, ebbing lower. I didn't use iron on him. Instead, I leaned down and kissed him. Ten. "This is a terrible decision," I thought. "I've gone completely mad, and I need to stop this instant." But then Rook made a sound and parted his lips beneath mine, and I'm afraid that for a time I ceased listening to my brain entirely. I lost myself in the hypnotizing press of give and take, the odd but intoxicating feeling of joining my mouth with his. Soon I felt Rook's palm slide down my back, and in one graceful, powerful movement, he swept me up in his hands. I automatically tightened my legs around his waist and hooked my arms around his neck, boggling at how high off the ground he'd lifted me. It was almost like riding him as a horse again, a thought that made me turn red as a tulip. He took a few steps across the clearing, and a tree's rough bark pressed against my back. That touch was enough to jostle me partway back into reality. Even though Emma had been careful to educate me on the specifics of this sort of thing, or perhaps because she had, quite frankly, a surge of nervousness warred with desire in the pit of my stomach. Noticing how rigid I'd gone, Rook drew back. He waited, his breath soft on my face. His lips were flushed, almost bruised. I wondered what I looked like, and recalling the pimple, instantly wished I hadn't. I said. "I've never, that is to say..." I completely lost my nerve. "Are your teeth still sharp, technically? Because they don't feel sharp at all. I don't understand how that works." He was breathing heavily, eyes unfocused. He frowned a little, coming back to himself as he processed my anxious carrying on.
"I've never made a study of glamour's properties. All I know is that it isn't the same as shape-shifting, but it's more than a mere illusion. I won't harm you."
My reluctance dawned on him. His shoulders stiffened.
"If you'd rather not..."
I swooped in and silenced him with another kiss. I moved too fast, and our noses bumped together, which hurt a bit, but he didn't seem to mind. My heart still hammered like a frightened rabbit's. By reflex, I tightened my fingers in his hair, and again he made that noise, the one that pulled me taut as a bowstring inside. I flexed against him without meaning to, and both heard and felt his braced palm slide down the bark next to my ear. Fascinated, I studied him. He met my eyes. I gave his hair a second experimental tug. He let his head fall a little to the side in the direction of my hand. Somehow I knew what that meant. He'd give me complete control if I wanted it. A rush of pure, unadulterated want knocked the air out of my lungs and, ironically, knocked some sense into my brain. "We can't do this," I exclaimed. "We're stopping. Now. Oh, God." I loosened my legs and gripped his shoulders to let myself down. He got the hint before I took an ignoble drop and lowered me to the ground. His face had gone a bit gray, and his expression was stricken. I demanded of him, "Have we broken the good law? Did that count?"
"No,"
he replied hoarsely.
"Not unless..."
He halted and shook his head.
"No,"
he repeated in a surer voice. He cleared his throat.
"If fair folk and mortals broke the good law every time we, kissed each other, suffice it to say there'd be few of us left."
"Sex really does turn people into imbeciles," I said, amazed at having committed yet another base human error to which I'd somehow thought myself immune. "Brooke, we can't do that again. I'm really using the iron next time. That isn't a bluff." White-lipped, he went over and claimed his coat from the ground.
"Good,"
he said, and he seemed to mean it. I tugged my dress straight, straightened my bootlaces, and yanked a bunched-up stocking back over my knee, wishing I had more to do to keep my hands busy so I didn't have to look at him. What I'd just done was so unlike me I could hardly believe it. The Autumn Land's magic wasn't affecting me in some way, was it? I couldn't shake the feeling that something dark lurked at the periphery of my recent memories, an unsettling experience I'd forgotten somehow, like a bad dream. And as soon as I thought that, one of the shadows that had been haunting me all morning sharpened into focus. "Hemlock," I blurted out. Rook whipped around with his sword drawn. "No, not here. Not right now, at least. I think I saw her last night, or maybe I just dreamed about her." Already I'd begun doubting myself. The image of Hemlock perched in the branches was intangible, slipping away the harder I held on. "I'm not sure. If it had been real, I wouldn't have just rolled over and gone back to sleep." He examined my face carefully. Part of his shirt had come loose from his trousers, and I bit back the urge to snap at him to tuck it back in.
"You are not prone to flights of fancy,"
he said. At least he knew that much about me.
"Fair folk can deepen a mortal sleep if we wish, to move about unnoticed nearby. It is common for mortals to interpret such visits as dreams. But that would mean..."
"She's already found us," I finished slowly, apprehension weighing down the words. In one clean arc, he swept his sword through a stand of mushrooms, sending their caps flying. Then he stood with his back turned, leaning on the hilt, struggling not to project his defeat. Now I understood why Hemlock's actions exacted such a personal toll. He was already insecure about his suitability as prince, and the ease with which she tracked him through his own domain was yet another mark against him. But I had witnessed Rook's power firsthand, and couldn't believe it was as simple as that. "She tried to tell you something," I said, dredging up the details, frustrated that I could recall so little of use. "I think she was delivering a warning. She said it's only you now, and that she no longer answers to the Horn of Winter. Do either of those mean anything to you?"
"No, but there's an ill sound to both."
He sheathed his sword.
"Isabel, I..."
The pause spun out into an agonizing silence. When he resumed, I could tell every admission cost him.
"I was not lying, of course, when I told you I haven't yet fully recovered. I relied upon losing the wild hunt for several days at least. If we are attacked on the return journey, when we're attacked, I fear I may not be able to protect you."
I bit my lip and looked down. The heat between us had dissolved, a smoldering fire reduced to soggy ashes. "There must be another option."
"Revisiting the Summerlands would be futile, if not perilous. The Winterlands are out of the question, as is..."
He hesitated.
"My own court, given recent events. But Hemlock wouldn't dare accost us if we went straight to the Spring Court. We could stay several nights and return to Whimsy along a safer route.
No human had ever visited a fairy court and lived, or at least none had ever done so and remained human. I was a master of the craft, escorted by a prince, but I had to wonder whether I truly was a special case, or if every mortal deluded themselves into thinking they were an exception to the rule. I took a deep, shaky breath. I do have many patrons in the Spring Court. Rook bowed his head in agreement.
If anything were to happen to me, Gadfly would honor your desire to return home. Of this I am certain.
And once I'm back in Whimsy...
We shall never see each other again,
he said,
for one reason or another.
A pain that had nothing to do with anything physical twisted in my chest. What would happen to Rook after we parted? I imagined him returning to the Autumn Court, walking down a long, dim hall, and taking a seat on a throne with 1,000 eyes upon him, all searching for a sign of the human wrongness on his face, the wrongness my portrait had exposed. How long before he tripped, and his people bared their teeth and sprang upon him like wolves on an injured stag? How long would he last against them? I knew he wouldn't go easily, or quickly. But I was powerless to help him. I'd do well to remember that the only fate I had any control over was my own. Cold on the outside, aching on the inside, I nodded.
Then let us go,
he said, sweeping past me with his face turned away. A sparkling fall day greeted us beyond the glade. We walked for hours with no sign of the wild hunt, encountering nothing more dangerous than the occasional acorn dropping from a tree over our path. Surrounded by the forest's peaceful beauty, with the sun warming our backs, it was hard to remain pessimistic for long. Even Rook's steps lightened the farther we traveled without incident. "What are you smiling about?" I asked, bending over in another futile attempt to wipe the stickiness from the apples we'd found for lunch off my fingers, and watching him suspiciously.
"I just recalled the Spring Court holds a ball this time of year. If we haven't missed it, we might be able to attend."
"Yes, that seems like the perfect thing to do while fleeing for our lives," I said.
"Then we shall go,"
he concluded, pleased. I snorted, completely unsurprised. "Fair folk are impossible."
"That's irregular, coming from a human who can't even eat a raw hare."
Hastening along behind him, trying to keep up with his long strides, I decided not to argue about the hare. I was coming to realize that the craft was so enigmatic to fair folks I might as well have refused to eat meat unless it had been bathed in willow's tears under a new moon. Realizing that your own magic held more mystery to fair folk than theirs did to you was a peculiar experience. I felt like some sort of wizard with delicate and arcane indispositions, not an artist and a perfectly ordinary person. We passed a mossy boulder with a squirrel perched atop it. I turned to have a second look, and both the boulder and the squirrel were gone. Scanning the forest around us, I realized that though it was made up of the same types of trees we'd been walking through before, they weren't the exact same individual trees. I looked forward and looked back again. Yes, that ash with the overhanging branch had vanished. Straining my eyes, I thought I made it out a quarter of a mile or so behind us in the distance. With all the leaves in between, it was difficult to tell for certain. I remembered the old tales and faltered. "You aren't doing something with time, are you?" I asked. He looked at me loftily over his shoulder, which meant he was confused by my question but didn't want to admit it. "When I get back to Whimsy, I'm not going to find that everyone I know died a century ago, or that I've suddenly become an old maid, am I? Because if that's the case, you need to put it to rights." I said this firmly, trying to tamp down my rising alarm. "I just noticed the way we're traveling. Each few steps we take must add up to 15 minutes or more of walking."
"No, the Autumn Lands are merely doing my bidding and hurrying us along. You mean to say you haven't noticed it until now?"
I frowned, Indeed, I hadn't.
I give my word that time has passed normally since we entered the forest. What you're thinking of is an ensorcelment, and quite a nasty trick to play on humans. Which is precisely why it's done, of course,
he added. You had better not have done that to anyone, I warned him.
I haven't,
he said with feeling. He proceeded to ruin the effect by continuing.
It's always seemed tiresome. All they do afterward is leak a great deal, and then come back to the forest to shout at you.
I shook my head. God, what a menace. We walked on. One moment I was admiring a stand of fiery rowans, and the next I stepped into a different forest altogether. Everything was green. Not the rich, simmering greens of summertime, but pale greens, lacy greens, delicate gold greens, all layered up on the trees like icing and chiffon. Knee-high wildflowers parted around my legs. A bee droned sleepily past my face. Delighted laughter bubbled up in my chest. We were in the springlands. Can we stop for a moment? I called out. Rook hadn't paused and was now halfway across the clearing. Only if it's safe, that is. This is wonderful. I'd like to try to paint it once I'm home. He halted and gave me a furtive look. It's nearly as lovely as the autumn lands, I added loudly for the sake of his pride. That seemed to mollify him.
There's a place over here to sit down.
He ducked beneath some branches. When I caught up with him, he was sitting on the lip of a squat stone well halfway covered up by moss. Bluebells and feathery-looking ferns sprouted all around it. I sank down on the opposite side with my back turned to his, as that morning's events made keeping a distance seem wise, and considered taking my shoes off. Then I looked at the well and forgot all about wiggling my toes in the ferns. The well was small, old-looking, and unremarkable in every way. I looked at it for a long time. Rook said quietly,
I've brought you to the green well.
I shot up as though my buttocks had just landed on a bed of hot coals. A slushy sound filled my ears, and my vision darkened around the edges. Desperate to get away, I tottered over to a tree and leaned myself against it, breaking out in a clammy, crawling sweat. I'd never fainted before, but the feeling of being on the verge of it was unmistakable. He spoke again with his head angled, not quite looking at me over his shoulder. My abrupt movement puzzled him. I don't think he saw the extremity of my reaction.
Nothing will happen unless you drink from it. But I understand the opportunity to drink from the green well is many humans' dearest wish.
I slid down the tree trunk and sat uncomfortably on its gnarled, jutting roots, wildflowers tickling my legs. He was right. Of those mortals who vanished into the forest, the majority sought the green well, hoping to find it on their own despite the insurmountable risk. Masters of the craft toiled for years in pursuit of this end. Only perhaps one human every 100 years was bestowed with the honor. It was lusted after more than any enchantment, any glittering quantity of gold. And of all the things on earth, it terrified me most.
It occurred to me,
he went on,
that this might be an ideal alternative for you under the circumstances. You would no longer require my protection or fear any of the forest's dangers. You could come and go in the autumn lands, and any other fairy court,
he hastened to add.
As you please. And, of course, you would live forever.
Somehow I found my voice. I can't. This time he did look at me. Absorbing my expression, he stood up halfway.
Isabel, have you taken ill?
I shook my head. A pause.
Are you starving to death?
He asked nervously. I briefly squeezed my eyes shut, swallowing a painful laugh. No. It's the green well. Rook, there's something you must know about me. My craft isn't just something I do. My craft is who I am. If I drank, I'd lose myself and everything I care about. I know it's hard for you to understand because you've never been mortal, but the emptiness I've glimpsed within your kind frightens me more than death. I wouldn't consider the green well even as a last resort. I'd rather get torn apart by the Wild Hunt than become a fair one. He sank back down, absorbing my words. I'd expected to offend him, but he only looked a bit dazed, as though something had struck him over the back of the head. Perhaps the effort to comprehend what I'd said